Turning Point Coaching and Consulting presents Kairos Conversations, Connecting with Quality, the podcast. Kairos is Greek for the right time, the right season, the right opportunity. This podcast features healthcare quality professionals who share their journeys, their advice, their struggles, how they made that transition into a new and exciting role. My heart's desire is that you find this podcast to be inspirational to you as you make your own journey. Don't forget to share this podcast with your colleagues and friends and rate us on whichever podcast platform you listen to. Thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in today. Today, I'm here with my next guest, Jordana Rutigliano. Thank you so much for being here, Jordana.
Thanks, Brandy, for having me.
Let's start by introducing yourself to the audience.
So I'm Jordana. I'm a licensed social worker by background. I always start with that because it's a real important part of my identity. But I've spent most of my career working in integrated mental health and health operations. And I'm also a career coach on the side.
Awesome. I do want to talk about your journey as a career coach, but let's start by how did you get into social work?
Yeah, I have kind of a traditional background, and I, of course, like knew people who needed mental health services growing up, and I always wanted to be a therapist. So when I looked at the options, I said, social work sounds good. I can have a degree in a couple of years. And I didn't know a lot about being a social worker until I actually pursued my graduate education and then really just fell in love with it even more. The social justice orientation, the anti-racism lens that sort of weaved into the work. So it really became an important part of my identity, and I was able to be trained as a therapist and do what I always knew I wanted to do.
Awesome. So as a social worker, what kind of settings did you work in, and what kind of work did you do?
I had some interesting experiences early on. My first internship, I'll never forget it. I was placed in the Suspension High School in New York City, one of the five Suspension High Schools. They had one for each of the boroughs. And so I commuted daily to this school in Brooklyn where they had essentially all the kids who had gotten kicked out of the New York City high school system.
Oh my gosh.
So that was my first experience in social work. And it was such a great learning experience and a really hard population for me to connect with, especially being so young and so new. But it taught me a lot. And after that, I got placed in an SRO in Brooklyn, which is a kind of supportive housing for individuals with serious mental illness. So very different population, but I really fell in love there as well. I'll never forget the experience of one day we were taking the group to a Yankees game, actually. And so I rode the 4 train all the way from Brooklyn to the Bronx with a group of these adults. And it was really the first time that I also like understood the stigma that's really experienced in that population too, like just the looks and the reactions being on the subway as a group. So these like early experiences really shaped me and taught me a lot just about the world outside of the bubble that I had been in prior to that. And then finally, I made it into a community health center where I actually spent about the first 10 years of my career. I absolutely loved working in primary care with such varied populations. But the thread through all of that was that these were really people who had not been able to access care, primary care, or mental health care anywhere else, usually due to cost or just having no access in their communities. So I really loved that and stayed a long time.
So what were you able to do for them to help with that access to care?
When I started at the first community health center I worked at, we had a couple of sites throughout New York City and then eventually also expanded, merged with another community health center that was upstate New York, like in the Hudson Valley. I think one of the things that felt most important was that we really, and especially speaks to my interest in mental health in particular, was we really focused a lot on building out the integrated mental health services. I had a boss and a mentor early on who was really involved in integrated primary care and mental health models, especially a model that I still love and work in today called collaborative care, that sort of embedded these mental health services directly in primary care centers, either virtually or also kind of like directly physically located. And what that did, I think, why I love it so much in terms of expanding access is, you know, one, a lot of people don't identify that they have mental health challenges. And so when they go for their annual checkup and get screened and connected right away, it can be really effective in educating them. And that immediate access is really important for engagement. So I think that it just expands it exponentially and kind of takes it out of the realm of being separated, which I think it is too much. You know, like, oh, go up to the second floor and meet with the counselor, the social worker, and then everyone knows kind of what's going on with you. Whereas if you do it alongside the doctors, it's, you know, it's kind of more private, more accessible in some of those really important ways.
Yeah, so it brings some dignity to the person that needs assistance, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think doing that in different types of communities and being able to work alongside the doctors to really understand their patient population's needs, whether that was different cultural or linguistic needs or, you know, just their likelihood to engage in certain kinds of models of care is just really, has been really key, I think.
Yeah. So how long did you do that work or when did you stop working in that particular subset of the field?
Yeah, I did that and I really grew in leadership there too. It was such a great experience. And I was there for almost 10 years after graduating, probably like 9 years, which is a long time in community health center world.
It is because it's heart work, right? It takes from you from the perspective of you're giving your whole self to this work, while it can still be very inspirational and very fulfilling. It's still a labor of love, I would say.
Yeah, definite labor of love. And that was, it was an interesting time too. It kind of overlapped with Obamacare was passed and a lot of the sort of like early accelerated value-based care reforms that were happening at the time, which really did a lot to like expand what we were able to do, especially with Medicaid populations and people who had not had insurance before and just access to new services and the early days of ACOs. And so I kind of lived through all of that, but yeah, it's a lot in it. You do put your all into it. And after a while, you need a break, which I did. And I spent a few years after that in exploring different settings. I worked at the city government for a while and at a payer for a while, and then kind of transitioned into startup worlds, all really focused on this integrated care lens.
So for anyone who wants to take a similar journey going into integrated care, what advice would you give them?
I think, and I'd say I'm still on the journey too. I've mostly done this in primary care and then I'm recently now working somewhere where we're doing this in specialty care settings, which there's so much to learn and things I'm still learning about how differently healthcare can work in different types of settings and groups. You know, I think one thing that I'd say to anyone interested in that is that just being together in the same room sort of like isn't enough. When I think about real interdisciplinary care and using my lens as a social worker too, I really think the value is in deeply understanding what everyone brings to the team and really getting that buy-in for the team-based model. I think it doesn't work without that. And so if you don't have, yeah, you know, if you're working alongside people that are sort of just interested in doing their part of their bubble, staying in their bubble and kind of not coming out of it, it can feel a little disempowering. So I'd say really build the relationships. That's really the key piece. And I think that's been an important throughput for me in my career too, is just the power of relationships, kind of all the way up and down the care model.
Yeah, because the whole goal of integrated care is not to be in silos, right? And you're saying that sometimes people can still be in their own bubble and focused on just their part of the puzzle.
Yeah, it's so easy. It's easy to practice that way, I think. I think, you know, and there's a lot of talk around burnout, which is a very real thing. I'd say especially accelerated over the last few years, as many people have spoken about, you know, and at a certain point, like the energy that you have to take that extra step and knock on your colleague's door or make the phone call or send the message, you know, it takes energy that isn't always there. And so I think those relationships and that kind of like extra care is often the first thing that gets deprioritized in these sort of like high volume settings.
I want to pause for a moment to share something with you, my friend. After landing several non-clinical roles and coaching others to do the same, I have found that if you're running into roadblocks making that pivot out of direct patient care, it's because of one of three reasons. One, you haven't quite figured out what you want to do yet, and that's okay. But take the time to dive deep to figure that out. Number two, your resume screams clinician. And number three, you haven't demonstrated value and impact in your current role. Regardless of which reason resonates most deeply with you, I'll share some resources to help in the show notes section of this podcast. So, what was your defining point?
Oh, gosh.
A loaded question.
Yeah. Oh, personally, I mean, I just mentioned burnout. I guess I would have to say that for me, after riding this train for about 14, 15 years, and especially working in startups, which are just really intense. And after a couple of years of doing that, I really felt that burnout deeply myself, physically, mentally. I had been leading very large teams, you know, serving tens of thousands of patients, caring for the mental health and the crises coming up every day. It just became sort of too much for me to keep going at that pace. And I wound up taking a sabbatical at that point and taking some time to rest, but also finding a coach who worked with me to really figure out how to get me back on a path to loving this work and doing it in a way that was aligned with my values long term, and how I could make that work for the rest of my career. And so I really had to spend the time doing that work, figuring out how to adjust some of the bad patterns that I had for overwork and, you know, kind of burning out on empathy, I guess, and so that I can go back and do it effectively again. And when I did that, I really was more intentional about the kinds of companies I wanted to work with, and the importance of quality in the work too, not letting that get lost in kind of the other priorities.
So can you talk about that a little more? Because I feel like that's a big part of what my audience goes through and wants to know is, you know, when you get to that point of burnout or where you need a break, how do you reframe and shift to being more intentional about your search and figuring out how companies are going to align with that? How did you, I know you said you had a coach, but can you talk about how that worked for really taking that time to figure that stuff out?
Yeah, absolutely. This is so important and something I care so deeply about now. For me, on my journey, it was really about, I'd say, two things. One, like unlearning some of the patterns and pressures that I feel like I grew up around or that are common in the healthcare culture of just the more work, the better, always giving to your team, to your patients, never taking care of yourself. These are kind of like cultural embedded in the culture of a lot of healthcare institutions. So mm-hmm. a big part of that for me was figuring out how I could care for myself as much as I cared for everybody else. And that meant prioritizing rest, understanding how rest is productive and actually makes me a better worker. So I say that, and there's a lot of like work that went into understanding it, actually a lot of work that felt very therapy-like, which I had never sort of applied that lens to myself, but really, so kind of getting rid of those limiting beliefs around if I wasn't doing and giving all the time, that I was not helping people enough and not doing enough. So that was one thing. And then the values lens was also really important. And I think this relates to finding another job or role that can be fulfilling, especially if you've experienced burnout. So I had to like really, I'd say, step back for the first time. I had gone from, you know, being in school to building my career and being really busy all the time. And I've always just hopped around to job after job and opportunity after opportunity, but I never really thought about what I like to do. I had developed a lot of skills in a lot of different areas. Like my resume was fine. I had a lot of experience, but I couldn't answer the question of what really gave me joy. Mm-hmm. And so I had to really audit a lot of, go back to looking at all of my experiences. What did I like about them? What did I hate with them? Hate about them, and how did that relate to the culture I was working in, and what was important to me? And from that, I was able to really identify some values and some sort of like non-negotiables that were going to be important to me going back to work and finding a company that I really felt like would embrace that alongside me. And so just having that list and having that filter going forward really made that possible for me to find the joy in the work again. So I got really lucky on that.
Were you able to find that, like a company that aligned with your values and that you feel joy and that you feel like you have a sense of purpose to your work?
I did actually. I was able to find that. It didn't happen right away. And I'm always like cautious as a social worker too, that to mention the privilege that I have and being able to kind of take my time and be really picky. I know not everyone has that opportunity. So I acknowledge the privilege that I have in having had that opportunity, but I really took my time and didn't rush it. And I also learned to ask different questions, right? Not just to be selling myself, but to also be expecting that a company should want to work with me because of who I am authentically. So first I have to believe that. And second, finding the ways to ask the questions to understand whether that was the case or not. And so right now I'm lucky to be working at another startup that I feel like really does that well and has a leadership team that shares a lot of the values I do about keeping quality at the forefront and also caring for our care teams just as much as we care for our patients.
That's awesome. And this is a side note, but people want to know what it's like to work for a startup. And I know you may not know the culture of every startup, but what is startup life like?
It's so funny because when people ask me this question, I say, I thought I would be the last person to ever work in startups. People who know me are like, you love structure and you're so organized and such a planner. And that is who I am as a person, like to my core. But somehow I've really come to enjoy the sort of like loose, creative energy that exists in in a lot of startups. They, depending on the stage, it can be very different, but a lot of the positive aspects of working in a startup are that there's a lot of opportunity to build things, to flex creative muscles that I never got to flex when I worked in kind of larger or more established health systems and institutions, to actually feel like you're part of something cool, building something new and different and exciting. But it can be very chaotic. There's not a lot of structure. You're building, the metaphor I always use is like building the ship while you're sailing it. That's how it feels every day. And so you've got to kind of have some flexibility and adaptability for sure.
So is there this work-life harmony that many people are looking for? Like when you go home at the end of the day, are you able to turn that off? Or does startup life require you to work from home in the sense of working after the workday is over?
That's such an, and I love that work-life harmony. I've seen that recently, and I love it over like the traditional work-life balance. I think that's a, for me, like that is really, it's very personal. I used to have pretty bad boundaries, and part of the work I think I've done is being kinder to myself on what those boundaries look like or have to be. And so I think when, like I'm in a position where like I am in charge of clinical care that's happening, mental health care that's happening. And so to some extent, as the senior operations leader, I have to be available, you know, like extended hours sometimes so that if a clinical emergency happens, you know, like I'm here and I'm supporting my team. But I also know and feel comfortable that when I have stuff to do during the day, that I can and should step away and rely on my team to support me when I need to be out. And I feel like I've found the right balance for me in that. And that might look different for somebody else. I will say that working from home, like for jobs that are fully remote, and I've been working from home since March 2020, like a lot of people, is hard. I do wish a lot of the time for more actual human-to-human interaction. That is probably the hardest part of it for me, is sort of never being face-to-face with people.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I still work on site, you know, in a hospital system, and I can see how if I was fully remote, I would miss that human-to-human interaction, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And yet it would still be nice to have some days at home. So there's like this hybrid situation that I think a lot of people are looking forward to.
I would love that, like 1 or 2 days in the office. And then, yeah, here in my comfy pants, the other part of the week would be perfect.
Yeah, and being able to choose which days those are. Because, like you said, if you need to flex during the day to do something or to handle a situation or a personal appointment, then you should be able to do that, right? You should be able to have that flexibility to your day.
Yeah.
So you say that you do coaching now, Jordana. So what does that look like? And how did you pivot from the clinical work that you were doing to coaching?
Yeah. So this is sort of an interesting story as well. But when I was sort of going through my burnout period, I was feeling really lonely and isolated too. And I sent out a message to like all of my friends and colleagues. And I said, you know, like we're all a bunch of like great professionals. Like, I just want to get everyone on a call like once a month. And I really just think we can like support each other as peers. And so, and I wound up calling that. I just like, hey, you're all kick-ass people, like come on a call with me. And I did that and people showed up and then they showed up again the next month. And we talked about supporting each other's careers. And so like a few months into doing that, I decided to formalize it and say that this is like my kick-ass careers network. And so I sort of naturally launched this side business called Kick-Ass Careers. And I just found that I got so much joy out of that. Just again, deepening the human connection. I get so much joy out of connecting people who never would have met, but I just can see that these two people should kind of like meet and could help each other. And then eventually I kind of got this itch that probably brought me to social work in the first place to like work with people one-on-one and really like dig in like I did very early in my career and haven't done in a while. And given where I'm at in my life, I wanted to do that to support others' kind of career journey, career transition. And so started taking some coaching clients one-on-one on the side as well. And so Kick-Ass Careers is still a little early, but growing. And it's something that I just love to do because it gives me that sort of missing deep, deep connection that I used to have very early in social work.
So the people that you coach are social workers, or what's the client that you work with?
A lot of my clients are in the mental health profession, and a lot of them have had similar experiences of burnout, not all of them, but a lot of them are looking for how they can use their skills that they honed kind of working with clients in either other parts of healthcare or unfortunately, like there's a lot of the mental health workforce that is thinking about pivoting away from that, you know, totally due to burnout. But that's sort of been my niche so far, is working with mental health professionals who are kind of looking for that transition into something better and more meaningful.
Okay, so career coaching for mental health professionals. Is this mid-career, early career?
Yeah, I'd say probably early mid-career, probably somewhere in the 5 to 10 year range is where most of my network and people I've worked with so far have been.
Okay. Anything else? Like if someone said, I want to work with Jordana, what else should they know about what they would expect when they work with you?
Well, personally, one of the things I tell people when I meet with them is I'm not a fan of like shoulds. So if you're looking to kind of work with someone that's going to tell you what to do exactly and give you direct advice, that's probably not going to be me. I really like to help people uncover their own solutions. That's just my approach. So that's one thing to know. So I'm really passionate about that, helping people kind of build their confidence through better understanding their values and what's important, and then finding some tactics to apply that going forward. So people can find me. One day I'm going to build a website. I've been procrastinating on that for a while, but so far I haven't had to. I'm kind of just naturally finding people who are a good fit. So I would send people to my LinkedIn page.
I will definitely post your LinkedIn handle so people can click on it and connect with you. And it'll be in the show notes part of this podcast episode. Anything else that people should know about you or your journey?
I mean, one thing I want to make sure comes across is that I feel incredibly hopeful, you know, about healthcare still, even having experienced just like that burnout journey and coming back from it. And I think it's so easy to feel frustrated every day. I do too. I mean, I'm a human being. I get bills from the local hospital system that are wrong. You know, like all of these things are so hard in healthcare. But I'm also just really optimistic at the end of the day that there are people, good people, like fighting every day to do things the right way, the human way, and to build the system up better. And so that's why I'm still in it, still working in it, still committed to it, you know. And so I just would want to make sure that that message that comes across is one that feels hopeful and optimistic for the future.
Well, what do you think, in your honest opinion, would be needed to help make healthcare safer for our patients, those that we serve, and also our colleagues?
Yeah, for me, like one of the reasons I feel hopeful about it is I think in my little world, especially of mental health care, I think those two things are just so like healthcare safety and quality and our workforce health is so linked together. I feel like it's one thing. And I see a lot of companies trying to do better with their mental health workforce. There's also a lot happening in the regulatory landscape for like social work compact licensure and some things that make it easier to reduce barriers to access and allow more people access to high quality clinical services, especially people who live in more remote areas where there's fewer services available. And those same things give our workforce choice and more power in negotiation. And so some of those developments make me really hopeful that that will continue to expand, and that I think those things will both help bring good quality healthcare to more people, mental health care to more people, and help empower our workforce to demand better, have higher wages, be more cared for by the organizations they work with, or on their own if they choose to demand higher reimbursement with payers that they should be entitled to. And so I think those things are happening out there. I see them happening, and it makes me hopeful that things will continue to improve.
Yeah, and I want to go back just for a minute for people who may not understand the impact of a compact licensure. Mm-hmm. And feel free to jump in on this. But what I will say is that for a lot of clinical professionals, you can only see patients in the state that you are. Yeah. So if my license is in Georgia, then I can only see patients who also live in Georgia. So we have to be in the same state sometimes for even like telehealth visits and things like that. So if you have less of that particular type of professional, then someone who's in Ohio, say, may not be able to access, you know, the care that I could provide them because we're not in the same state if I don't also have a license in the state that they live. So a compact licensure allows healthcare professionals of certain disciplines to have the ability to see patients in multiple states.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you'd think that telehealth would have accelerated that in the last few years, but it's still been an uphill battle in a lot of the professions to move that forward in nursing and in social work and even in medicine. But it's happening.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you said that too, because that is something that needs to be said and needs to be shared, is access to care is not as simple as just a telehealth visit or, you know, having enough clinicians, right? It's about removing barriers that would prevent someone from accessing care wherever they can get the care from. Because you have a lot of people who live in remote areas too that may not be able to get to the big city, quote unquote, to get to that clinician that's in the office, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You made me think back to my early community health center days again. And we had sites in upstate New York, including one in a town called Ellenville, New York. And, you know, I drive there from the city and I've never been there before. And there's all these like winding roads up a mountain. And, you know, just to see that like some of these sites are so remote. I mean, there's like one social worker there, which is even a lot for a town that size. So it's just, again, outside of my bubble, outside of the bubble, it can be very different depending on where you are.
Well, yeah. Well, I am so glad for this conversation, Jordana. It has been very enlightening for me. I think you are probably the first social worker that I've had on this podcast. So very grateful that you shared your journey and your experience and even what you're doing now.
Thanks so much, Brandy. Yeah, I really enjoyed this chat.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. It would mean a lot if you would share this episode with a friend or a colleague. I would be honored to encourage them in their journey too.